Okay, we are set. Now, if you all don't mind, I thought I might throw the first question out there. And this is a question that has to deal with interpreters. And one of the things that I'm noticing here at the HSC Pediatric Center is translation, whether it's for therapy or bedside nursing, if you're doing translation for patient or family training, that is very dynamic. And I want to pose the question out to everybody. What methods are you all using with regards to the use of interpreters? Meaning, do you use interpreters in person? Do you use interpreters over the phone? How do you engage them with any type of translation?
Mary Ann McGuire, the Children's Institute in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Hey, Mary Ann. First question
Hi.
Out there. Hey. Does anyone want to take a stab at that first question as far as use of interpreters, particularly with educational moments with families or patients? Are you using face-to-face?
Yeah, this is Susan from Mount Washington in
hey,
Baltimore,
Susan.
Maryland. We centralized our language services about 3 years ago. Fortunately, we're somewhat supported through our foundation to help with the expense. We were able to send individuals to a program through Johns Hopkins that certified them to serve in the role as interpreters, as opposed to utilizing individuals that, let's say, were bilingual of different languages. They actually centralized, if they themselves cannot interpret, they access language services through a variety of means. But it's all coordinated through them. So we have a hotline that allows it to be scheduled at any time at any of our sites and then be able to have the individuals present on site or through a teleconferencing medium.
Now, through a teleconference medium, is that video, do you mean,
or just phone?
There's both.
There are services out there that do both, and because of some of the languages, we're fortunate to have access to a large university hospital that has a lot of interpreters with different backgrounds and languages. So.
Okay.
Hello, this is Myra.
Hello, Myra. Welcome to our discussion today. How are other folks managing the use of interpreters with any type of conversation, whether it's education or whatnot, when you don't have the luxury of, you know, being part of a large institution?
This is Mary Ann from the Children's Institute. We have a contract with an interpreting company here in Pittsburgh. And so if we need those services, we're able to call. And then depending on, this is a pediatric setting, depending on what the schedule is for when parents will be here and when we need someone here to attend therapy with them and that, we go ahead and set that up through a company who then assigns and sends out an interpreter.
Okay, so it sounds like you do a lot of face-to-face.
Yes, it's all, well, most of the time it's face-to-face, not always. Every once in a while it's by phone. And sometimes we have staff that are able to function in that capacity.
Now, I found at the HSC Pediatric Center, we did try to do as much face-to-face as possible, but what we ran into, and I'm curious if other folks have run into this, is when we do this type of interpretation for outpatient, what happens when the family cancels and the person's here face-to-face? We're finding that it started to become cost prohibitive. Do you run into that?
Absolutely. Yeah, we've had situations where we've set up a schedule and then the interpreter shows up and the family doesn't.
And
they you know, they have various reasons for it from time to time. And so, I mean, there are times where we have to sit down with them and say, you know, if you don't show up, someone has to incur these costs, and that can't be the hospital. So that seems to be it overall.
Does anyone else have any thoughts in relation to interpretation?
Carol Simmons at Children's Healthcare of Atlanta, and we do use interpreters when we don't have access to a bilingual therapist, and we have the same issues that sometimes the interpreter shows up and we do have to pay them even if the patient does not show up. But my question and some of our challenge is when it's speech therapy that we need to be providing, that without the bilingual SLP and using the interpreter, it's hard for the therapy. The evaluation we can do, although it's difficult to evaluate the articulation with an interpreter and not a bilingual SLP. So I'm wondering what people are doing about that.
I don't know. I mean, we have our interpreters go to therapy with the kids, and you know, they provide the interpretations during therapy.
Okay, this is Kelly Cordero. I'm a speech pathologist. And this is probably one of the biggest questions that I'm asked in regards to use of interpreters. And my spouse is actually an interpreter, and he said for the most part speech therapy is the last place they all want to be sent because it's some of the most challenging visits to interpret for, because when I talk about this, I say it's one of the few times where they're in our medium. Like, it isn't like that the communication is occurring in support of the service. It is the service. And so I think I agree with the initial question in relation or comment in relation to how challenging it can be to assess articulation. I think that we're trying to work on things for that in terms of we use models a lot where individuals do like repeat, like where I'll have the interpreter and the try to imitate, or I'll have the interpreter say the word if it's an old enough patient that they're willing to repeat, have the interpreter say, patient say, until I can determine whether they're the same. And I use a lot of, if it's a language that I have no knowledge of and where it's really some of the languages we see here that are the newer to our state where we don't have a lot of resources in them and we can't have done our homework as well as we'd like to ahead of time about what things we're expecting. And I also use family members and parents to tell me, does that sound the same to you? Does this, you know, I'll use that. It's clearly not the same as how we would normally do an articulation assessment, but I think there's some information we can gather that way. We also have an exception to our policy here, just some things I'm thinking of in specific with speech therapy. We don't generally let have an assigned interpreter. We do a lot of interpreters from agencies, except our two interpreters in-house. This is at Gillette Children's in St. Paul, Minnesota. We have two Spanish interpreters on staff. The rest of everything we use for the hospital is either over the phone, only if there's such low incidence we can't get it in person, or in person from an agency. And generally it rotates who those folks are, but for speech visits we do, if it seems appropriate for the therapist, we do try to have, like, we do request a consistent person, which can help you build that relationship with the child so that they're sort of familiar. It becomes a little less awkward having that another person in the interaction. So we kind of have an exception to our policy in that sense. And we use in terms of the education question, we use our teach-back model. Still, we try hard and feel it's important to do that with interpreters. You know what I mean? And it's even more important then because you're less familiar as a provider with how that individual is taking your message and learning from it in terms of home programming instruction or things you might be giving. I'm sorry if that was a long answer.
Yeah, that was helpful. Thank you.
We actually have done pretty much similar to what was just described at Gillette. However, we found that once the community knew that we had bilingual therapists, particularly Spanish-speaking, which is the largest growing group in our community, we found that our capacity was so challenged because all of a sudden the referrals increased dramatically. And we actually even had to start offering some different types of programming that we worked with our legal office on as it related to group programming and really trying to have the interpreter present, but if it was appropriate for the child to put them more in a group format with the family in order to work with them. An example was, you know, we have a large weight management program for children that deals with psychology and nutritional counseling and medicine. And we found out that we had done all this translation into Spanish and found that most of our children actually did not read Spanish, but their parents did. So we had to have the interpreters there to assist with what we kind of assumed when we first started this kind of group format that was very focused on education for the family. And that really made us kind of turn around and look at what we were doing and then change that up because of it.
Thank you, Susan. So Susan from Mount Washington in Baltimore, Maryland. Anything anyone else wants to share in relation to the interpreters? Or does anyone have any other question they'd like to bring up as far as their experience with both the cultural and linguistic aspects of treatment?
This is Candace from Gillette. Kelly, I'm not sure. I had to step away for a minute. Did you talk a little bit about the project looking at Skype for interpreters and that pilot?
No, I did not mention that.
Okay. I just, and I'm not sure. I just was introduced to it last week, I think, but how successful that may be for us in helping to bridge that face-to-face encounter. And again, it wouldn't be ideal for any of our therapies, but more for the evaluation process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we actually had been discouraged by legal because it's not secure. And so we've been asked never to use Skype with respect to patient care in any capacity.
And I may have misspoken by using the word Skype. This is a secure network where
right.
the interpreters are available. But
Yeah. That's, I think, what some, I know locally one of our schools is using that. And again, it's not Skype. I don't know, actually. I could probably find out the service that they're using, but they actually call in, and it is secure, and they can set it up with the classroom and the family and do, like, even conferences that way with the interpreter.
Great. I know at HSC we have also just recently switched to a different service that offers the video medium, and we're hoping that with that addition with video, it will, number one, bring our costs down a little bit, and hoping it will improve just the quality of the type of interpretation we're getting. And it is also a secured means of using interpretation as well. Any other questions out there?
Well, I just wanted to say something about I thought the presentation was excellent in the way that the participants presented their questions and how really you can better focus the needs of the family that way. And I thought that was really excellent because it made us all stop and listen and say, you know, maybe we do perpetuate some generalities that we should not, that are really our own in prejudices that really should not, or biases that should have never come out. And by really asking those questions, it really showed a lot of insight and awareness. So I thought it was really excellent.
Actually, you brought up a really interesting topic, and that has to do with cultural competency related to staff education. I'm curious if how many institutions out there actually have a cultural competency that they expose their staff to on any type of regular basis, whether it's annual or maybe a little longer than that. Is anyone willing to share what they have related to staff education? I know, for instance, at HSC, we do take an annual competency. It's an online competency that deals with the different cultures, like the diversity, and just some general understandings of what was mentioned in the webinar related to how certain cultures have certain traits and that sort of thing. So I'm just wondering if any other facilities have anything like that, and actually even if they're willing to share.
This is Lisa Smith from Cleveland Clinic Children's Hospital for Rehab, and we have an annual online module that all employees have to do. We also have a lot of in-depth kind of just-in-time training modules that we do if we have an inpatient or even an outpatient that has, you know, from a different background, or different language, in order to make sure that the folks that will be interacting with those patients one-on-one are aware of anything they may need to know culturally. And that seems to be working really well.
This is Susan again. Because I'm a CARF surveyor and I get out to different organizations, one of the things that we've been suggesting is that sometimes it's really important if you keep a really detailed database about the different cultures that you are addressing, because you start to then have data later to look at some of the identified ways that we could have better met the needs of the family or addressed them or taught them. And, you know, sometimes it's all anecdotal, but we decided, you know, that I've seen people start to do that as they've developed a plan and how they're going to build their plan, and then that way they can go back to their database to say, you know, we found that when we worked with this particular, these were things we learned that we could then add to our competence program.
That sounds interesting.
This is this is Steve Kozak from Presley Ridge School for the Deaf in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. We do have an online training curriculum titled Respect and Dignity, and that is a requirement for all of the employees at Presley Ridge. I also had a question just from the previous conversation. It was one of the issues for us as a multi-service organization in about 7 or 8 states and in several foreign countries is that the Presley Ridge School for the Deaf also is unique to the organization regarding the difference between deaf culture, hearing culture, American Sign Language as a preferred communication versus English. So when members on this call were talking about interpreting, were you talking about bridging communication between hearing and non-hearing folks, or were you talking about bridging communication between different spoken and hearing languages?
I would say probably both. We, in fact, have had families who prefer that we do, especially for the hearing impaired, that we have always tried to be very patient-specific for what the family's needs were and how they wanted us to engage them. So in some respects, it required an interpreter, and some it required that we had to handle it differently. So I say that we try to focus on the individual's needs and what their preference is when we do that kind of work.
Okay.
This is Anne
at
HSC. Oh, I'm sorry. Am I interrupting somebody?
No, that was me. Go ahead. Anne, is it?
Yes, Anne. We are able, with our new system, over video, we are also able to do interpretation for the deaf. So that is included as far as just the different cultures.
Okay. Are you using like a Z5 or Z20 application, do you know, for that relay?
I have no idea what you just said.
Okay.
And again,
it's an emerging technology that allows for that interpretation to occur.
I know, you know, with the company that we use, it's and like I said, it's very new to us. It's called Lionbridge, and they offer quite a number of different languages, and the hearing impaired is definitely one of them.
Yeah. I know our Presley Ridge Director of Communication Services is on the line, but when she got on, she did say she wasn't feeling well and has no voice, so she could interpret or sign, but that wouldn't help us on this phone call. At any rate, one of the things that we're looking at Presley Ridge in the state of Pennsylvania as a result of a civil suit that occurred with a deaf child not receiving the appropriate mental health services, we think that going forward in the future, that a more specific certification will be required rather than just proficiency in ASL, American Sign Language, because as we know, as the moderator said, both educational and mental health is really full of jargon and, in fact, oftentimes has its own its own language inside the English language. And then we're also tend to use a lot of letters and abbreviations, just like on this call, people are identifying themselves as HBT or, you know, HSM or whatever, which isn't really even English. It's an abbreviation of, you know, a longer noun in English.
Oh, that's very interesting, yes.
And I hadn't thought, I mean, generally in our geography here in western Pennsylvania, we're looking to bridge mostly American spoken English with American Sign Language. But I can only imagine a further complication if English was not cultural first language of a deaf family who say Spanish, and that's not even American Sign Language if they were fluent in the sign of that particular country or background.
Okay. This is Anne again, and I'm just going to remind folks, if you can, to mute your lines, please. Press *6, and that way we won't hear any background stuff. Anything else related to the cultural aspects or staff education? Anyone else have any questions or comments? Very interesting to hear the view for the deaf culture, so thank you for that, Steve. I would like to pose another thought out there, and it's actually related to translation. So in other words, the written format, and how are folks managing written documentation, whether it's evals, teaching programs, discharges? I have to say, this is a challenge where I work as far as doing it on a routine or regular basis. How are folks handling the actual documentation piece?
This is Myra from Hershey. Although it's not optimal, one of the ways that the staff has used is just Google Translation, and there's an option where you can type in what you want to say, and on the other side it types out what, you know, the translation to whatever, and it has helped with being able to translate with families on the fly versus, you know, getting onto the translator phone. And some of that has been utilized to reinforce information that's been discussed with the translator. But you're always at the risk of not having the words translated properly.
This is Carol from Atlanta. And, yes, we have had the challenge that it's quite expensive if we were to take every evaluation report and have it translated into the language of the patient's family. What we have done, of course, we use all of the, you know, having an interpreter there and providing the information, feedback, and education. If we have a family that we, that the therapist feels did not grasp the information in the evaluation that we were providing, or where it would put the child at risk if the family did not fully follow through with the home programming or education, then we will, that small subset, we will have translated. We will pay for the translated report and have it available in the native language. So there is some judgment call in there, but that's what we've done to be able to meet that small subset where we feel it's very crucial for them to get that report in their native language.
Would anyone else like to share as far as how they are managing the documentation piece in relation to translation?
Globally, we looked at the predominant languages that are spoken, and they did do some translation for, and I'm sure others have done this as well, for those most commonly used documents. We found that there are some services out there that can actually translate for home programs that actually some of the updated versions, and I don't necessarily want to promote a product, but the VHI product that has exercises or early intervention focus and oral motor focus, and you know, it's a computerized software program that allows you to select exercises to train. It has immediate translation built into the software, and you can choose which particular languages you want as part of your purchase. And it's not that expensive. And it just goes on computers where staff have access to creating a individualized home program for our family.
That sounds like a good way to at least handle the teaching piece. It almost sounds like we're all kind of in the same place as far as from an evaluation standpoint, and I'm assuming a discharge standpoint, where we're managing the interpretation piece through language, through verbal or visual, and it sounds like the documentation aspect, we're not... Not everyone is having access to that. It's only if we find a family needs that extra support. Does that sound like a fair statement?
I agree.
Yeah. So would anyone like to share any experiences or questions or comments related to linguistic or cultural challenges while trying to provide therapy services or any type of medical service? Okay. Well, we do have about several minutes left. Does anyone want to just bring up anything from a discussion or question standpoint that might not directly be related to culture since we have this time open? And we have multiple people on the line.
And this is Myra. I have a question related to the IPRC conference day that was just held. I was hoping to get to meet more people. I did get to meet Bonnie, which was great. But there was, at sign-offs, they said that there was an email that would be sent to verify that you attended. Do you happen to know how that works?
I don't know. Susan, do you have any thoughts on that?
No, unfortunately, Anne, I was not able to attend.
Yes.
Lisa, are you still on the call?
This is Lisa Smith. Let's talk with Bonnie about that. I don't remember seeing anything, but I left the conference and immediately went out of town, so my email is still a little bit ugly. excuse me, I'm sorry. If you like, feel free to email me. My email is smithe11@bcfcharliefrank.org, and I will find out from Bonnie.
I'll tell you what, I appreciate you offering your email up, but it's probably just as simple as I email Bonnie because I do have her email address. So
okay.
I do appreciate that very much, but I'll just, if she's the person to go to, I will go to her. But thank you.
So for other folks on the line, what Myra is referring to is the IPRC offered their first on-site educational day. It was a full day out, I believe, in Western Pennsylvania, correct?
Yes, it's the Seven Springs Resort.
And from what I understand, it went very well, and this is something that the IPRC is hoping to do on a somewhat regular basis, so hopefully next year we'll be hearing about their second annual conference, so that will be something to look forward to. I'm just going to give one more shout-out for questions before I just give some quick plugs for stuff coming down the pike towards the end of the year. Any other questions on anything?
This is Kelly Cordero from Gillette in St. Paul. I just wanted to thank the individual who provided the positive feedback about the conference. I think it's, as a speaker in this area, especially coming from a general majority background, I always am interested in how the message that we try to deliver is received and whether things feel helpful or not, and I really appreciated that feedback. I just also wanted to just put one comment in relationship to sort of thinking about training for staff here at Gillette. I know they're working towards, we've had some external consulting on diversity training, and we also have our only current, in my understanding, ongoing competency that's Gillette-wide is related to interpreters, and it's a really well-done module that's sort of one of those online interactive modules that you do once a year. That I think that it is so helpful as you work with individuals from different groups to be able to learn about the specific traits, but framing that always in sort of helping the staff to know the questions asked and what to look for, just because there's so many times families just aren't going to meet the traits that we have in our repertoire of things that we may know about some individuals from that group. So I think it's, you know, really helpful to wrap up the talk about like traits of specific groups with that bigger picture of, you know, just knowing those areas to look at really specific to those individuals. And so I just wanted to add that one comment. But thank you for inviting us again for this talk.
All right. Kelly, you brought up a really good point. What I would like to do, this is Anne, the chair for best practice. I would like to see if anyone's willing to share some of that staff education so that maybe we can post it on the IPRC website. I'm going to see if we can post our facility cultural education. I think it's pretty incorporates a lot, and that's at the HSC Pediatric Center. But it would be nice to post several if someone else would like to share their staff education with us. If anyone does, if you could email your education to me at bestpractice@iprc.info so that we could get maybe a couple sites up there. So I'm just asking for any educational material, staff education related to how we train our staff, and that can be emailed to bestpractice@iprc.info, and I'm the one who will pick that up. Any other questions or comments? All right, let's talk about what's next coming down the pike from IPRC. So our next webinar is going to be Thursday, December 11th, and the topic is going to be LEAN, that's L-E-A-N, and CPI in the rehabilitation environment. The speaker is going to be Laura Crooks. She is an occupational therapist from Seattle Children's Hospital. So that will be Thursday, December 11th. The webinar is free for organizational members, and it will cost $149 for non-organizational members. There will be a follow-up networking call very soon afterwards. It will be Monday, December 15th at 2 o'clock Eastern Time, so it will be the following week for a chance to have a discussion. To be a member of the IPRC, please go to our website, www.iprc.info. Membership is $500 for an organization for 1 year. Also, it would be nice to go to the IPRC website. It has recently been revamped, and there is more information on there. So please check it out, even if you are a member, www.iprc.info. If there are no questions or comments, I am going to conclude this discussion, and thank you so much. This will be available on the IPRC website shortly. Take care. Bye.
Bye. Thank you.
Thank you.